Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
We've put something together about how awful this year has been.
What happened in 2016 that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways?
From the ongoing crisis in Syria, to Zika, to Ryan Lochte being a douche, to a seemingly endless string of celebrity deaths.
2016, a year of triumph and defeat.
Either we just elected a president who didn't mean a single word he said, or we elected one who did. And it's impossible to know which one, because there is no longer a consensus on what a fact is.
How can philosophy help us understand the turmoil of the past 12 months?
Is the unexamined year even worth reviewing?
It turns out hindsight, much like the year we're all now desperately looking forward to, is 2020.
It's the examined year, 2016.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Please enjoy this tribute to a truly terrible year.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our program comes to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We continue conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner. That's on the Stanford campus where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for about 40 years.
40 wonderful years, John.
Yeah.
Now, today, it's a special edition of Philosophy Talk. We're calling it the examined year, 2016, a year of triumph and defeats.
From the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom to our own presidential election, it was a year of triumph for angry populace and defeat for old elites. We'll try to make philosophical sense of it with our Stanford colleague, Deborah Satz.
Despite the rise of populism, though, John, you know, it was actually a year of defeat for workers and triumph for technology. In 2016, Uber and Budweiser did something that has great impact on the future. They began putting self-driving vehicles into service, threatening to eliminate one of the last remaining well-paying jobs for less skilled workers. That's driving things from place to place. We'll discuss technology and the disappearance of work with Margaret Levy from the Center for Advanced Studies in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford.
On a lighter side, it was also a year of triumph and defeat in the world of sports. We'll discuss the agony and ecstasy of the year in sports with journalist and philosopher David Johnson.
And to get us started, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to the streets of Chicago, where the formerly hapless Cubs finally won the World Series for the first time in over a century, but against my Cleveland Indians.
This is going to be a tough play.
The Chicago Cubs had beat the Cleveland Indians. Cubs fans were beyond thrilled. People had waited generations for this moment. The Cubs hadn't won a World Series since 1908. Cleveland had a better year in basketball, where the Cavaliers rose up and beat the Golden State Warriors after their historic regular season record. Warriors fans were devastated. My six-year-old nephew cried into his Steph Curry sweater. 2016 was also a year of firsts. It was the first time a team of refugees competed in the Olympics. One of those refugees was an 18-year-old Syrian girl named Yusra Mardini. She helped keep a boat carrying her and a group of other refugees afloat when the engine failed off the Greek coast. Here's more from John Oliver.
She's pretty incredible. Just listen to her describe her training regime in Syria.
Sometimes you couldn't train because of the war. Or sometimes you had a training and there is a bombing in the swimming pool. When you have a problem in your life, that doesn't mean you have to sit around and cry like babies or something.
When something goes wrong, I don't cry like a baby. I cry like a grown man. And I'll tell you why. It's louder, it terrifies strangers, and no one comforts me. It's better.
None of the refugees won any Olympic medals, but they won a lot of hearts. They got a standing ovation during the opening ceremony.
Such love and admiration for these athletes. There are 10 of them.
2016, the year of historic triumph and defeat in sports, and the year of historic new beginnings for refugees with Olympic dreams. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for that report, and thanks to John Oliver, too.
We're joined now by David Johnson. He's a senior editor at the Stanford Social Innovation Review, and he's also a PhD in philosophy from Stanford. David, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
David, As we heard from Shuka's piece, 2016 saw some major triumphs and defeats in sports. A major feat can be absolutely crushing, like when our very own Golden State Warriors lost. But there can also be triumph in the face of defeat, like Yusra Mardini. Help us understand this. What separates winners from losers, especially when everyone's giving it their best shot?
Well, one side wins and one side loses.
I knew it was something like that.
But what's amazing about these athletes is, you know, coming up to, you know, a World Series or a Super Bowl or a NBA championship, they put in decades of work for this one moment where they're playing a game and it gets down to the fourth quarter, you know, to take basketball between the Warriors and the Cavaliers. And it's really just a matter of who's going to put the ball in the basket in the final minute of a game seven. And you might think, well, if the person, you know, say LeBron James, who puts the ball in the basket wins, then he's the winner. But really, you know, the side that loses got to the finals. They're an incredible team.
Yeah, but that was Kyrie Irving, I think, who put that last shot that sealed the fate of the Warriors. But you're right. I mean, two incredible teams locked in this combat. It's not Mortal Kombat, but it like replicates Mortal Kombat. We celebrate the winner. We feel bad for the loser. We don't mourn the loser, but we feel bad for the loser. The loser's disappointed. The loser's fans are crushed. But why? I mean, because the way you put it, it sounds like it's all a matter of luck. Why would we let our praise and blame hang so much on luck?
Well, that's what I was trying to get at, is that there is a lot of luck involved. And I think, imagine if the Golden State Warriors hadn't won the championship the year before. They had the best season last year of any team in NBA history, and they end up losing. People would think, geez, is this team full of chokers? Is Steph Curry not capable of winning the championship? And yet, we really, in retrospect, maybe shouldn't think that way, because they came against a great team and a great pair. So
you're telling us that the Cavaliers winning was not a matter of the gods' choice or fate or the way the universe is going to turn out since the Big Bang. It's luck. That's amazing. You really believe that?
I think there's more luck involved than we as fans watching these games and getting so passionate about the outcome realize. We think there's choking involved if somebody loses. We think they're not capable of when it's really just a matter of, will the ball go in the basket or not? And so, if you're, you know.
So, but that makes me think, okay, I know that in your days as a philosophy graduate student and after, you studied ancient philosophy. And I think of, I know you worked on Plato and Aristotle more than the Stoics, but the Stoics would say that's a really misguided attitude, because you should, and I used to coach baseball, and I used to tell my players this Stoic message: worry about the things that are within your control and don't worry about the things that are outside of your control, right? The things that are outside of your control is the bounce of the ball, is whether the opposing pitcher has his best stuff that day. You do your part. And shouldn't we celebrate? Okay, so these two teams play equally well, with equal dedication, with equal focus. Why shouldn't we celebrate the Cavs and the Warriors, the Cubs and the Indians equally?
Well, I think we should celebrate them more equally than we do, in the sense of these are incredibly accomplished people achieving things at the highest level of their sport. So I think we should celebrate both sides. However, the entertainment of watching sports is about who's going to win this game, who's going to win the championship. And so we get so passionately involved, we're trying to will our teams to victory, that when they don't succeed, we feel there must be something wrong. My hero choked. You know, they're just not capable of passing the final hurdle.
So quite apart from the Stoics, isn't there just a basic conflict between fandom and ethics, at least some forms of ethics? The utilitarian in me kept saying to me, the Cavaliers should win. I mean, Cleveland will be so happy. It's not doing very well economically. Look, we have so much here in the Bay Area. But the fan in me squelched that in about half a second. And so when the Warriors lost, I cried into my pillow, just like the kid on Shuka's report. Is there something basically ethically offensive about fandom?
Ethically offensive? I don't know. There's something irrational about fandom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as long as we take sports as entertainment, then it's perfectly fine to behave and talk the way we do.
But we take sports as more than entertainment. I mean, the pride of a city rides on the outcome of a contest.
Yeah, it is.
It's not just like passive watching and being entertained. It's like, it shapes our identity. It's a sign of deep loyalties. I mean, I've been an Indians fan since I was a kid. I haven't lived in the Midwest since I was 18 years old, but I'm still an Indians fan. And I root for Cleveland and all things Cleveland. And
It's certainly more than simply entertainment. I mean, one reason why a lot of the country was happy for Cleveland is because they hadn't won a championship in so long. And it's because it's a city that has been economically depressed. So we felt a lot of the country felt happy for them. Even I, a Warriors fan, felt happy for them that, well, we lost, but we lost to a city that really deserved that. It's been waiting so long to
right.
get the championship.
I mean, if the Indians had lost to the Yankees in Game 7 of the World Series after tying it up with that dramatic home run, I would have been like, not just disappointed, I would have been like, oh my God, the gods must be crazy. But that they lost to the Cubs under that circumstance, some part of me says, yeah, you go, Cubs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the other hand, the Cubs is, I mean, you got to feel sorry for Cubs fan who've lost their identity. I mean, you know, once hell freezes over, it's hard to remember who you are.
Right. I mean, the identity of being the lovable loser is no longer true. And it's same thing happened to the Boston Red Sox when they finally won their World Series. It's like, well, that team's now very different. And the identity of a Boston Red Sox fan and being from Boston is now different.
Well, see, this is one of the things I think about fandom, a deep thing. I think there are no Yankee fans. Right, because a fan is a person who persists through unrequited love, right? Through disappointment and betrayal. That is deep loyalty. Otherwise, you're just, I don't know, a bandwagoner.
Well, the Yankees haven't been that good lately, but you know, give them like two more decades of suffering, then maybe we'll feel sorry for them.
So, like, I want to just see. I mean, we're going to segue into politics in a little bit, but is political fandom like as being like the Democrats lost a crushing defeat? But did they give it their all? Should the Democrats feel like the Indians, well, next year is our turn kind of thing?
Well, certainly,
Hillary. That's absurd. We should nitpick everything in sight and blame it on the Russians.
Sorry. Well, I mean, Hillary, obviously a long-suffering politician who so desperately wanted to become president, ends up losing to Donald Trump after being favored to win. Mm-hmm. Sort of like a sports team that's right. Like absolutely should win and ends up losing, and you feel terrible for them. There's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking about Hillary's campaign. What really led to the loss? Was it the Russian influence over our election? Was it her poor campaigning and decisions about where to visit? And so we love to blame Hillary for all these things that happen when, in actuality, like an athlete, it may just been circumstances beyond her control.
So is triumph and defeat in the realm of sports a model of triumph and defeat in the realm of politics, would you say? Or is it really different? I mean, things hang on the outcome of an election in a way that they don't in the realm of sports, but maybe sports is a kind of safe way to play out all that stuff.
I think one lesson we can draw from sports is that if we want to blame a politician like Hillary for losing, we might have to reflect and see all the circumstances beyond her control that might have contributed to her losing, and maybe feel more sympathetic, more forgiving for what happened, more even-tempered about
so
the
we
result.
Maybe we should look at sports the way politics, the way we look at sports, under a Stoic point of view, to get back to ancient philosophy, is like, look at what the actor does that she or he controls and evaluate it from that perspective more.
Certainly, and I think also we've had a much more sort of forgiving attitude. We sort of, after the election result was clear, we sort of felt more forgiving about, you know, this is a person who tried really hard, who's worked, you know, spent a huge career in politics. We felt more, you know, sympathetic.
Yeah, well, outrageous fortune does a lot of things in sports and in politics. But David, on that note, again, thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been David Johnson. He's a senior editor at Stanford Social Innovation Review. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're looking through a philosophical lens at the triumphs and defeats that shaped the last 12 months. We're calling it the examined year, 2016.
The triumph of Trump and Brexit? Or was it the defeat of democratic pluralism? Who would have thought last January that we'd be starting 2017 in a world that looks destined for radical realignment?
It's the year in political disruption when Philosophy Talk continues.
It's here the family is broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Democracy came to the USA in 2016, all right. Well, I mean, except for California, it didn't quite make it here. Us Californians have about 3/8 of the political power of a resident of Wyoming or Delaware, but don't let me carp about that. Leonard Cohen, anyway, great song, and another musical loss of 2016. It's the examined year on Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're taking a philosophical look at some of the triumphs and defeats of 2016. Triumphs and defeats that challenged our assumptions, changed our world, and made us think about things in new ways.
We turn now to the year in political disruption. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to find out about how America reacted to the surprise victory of Donald Trump in the U.S. presidential election. And we'll start with the winner himself.
Ours was not a campaign, but rather an incredible and great movement made up of millions of hardworking men and women who love their country and want a better, brighter future for themselves and for their family.
Many saw this movement in America as a good thing. The political elites had been dethroned. It was a moment of celebration. But others were horrified by this movement. In their eyes, humanity, compassion, all things good had been compromised. Here's Rachel Maddow the night of the presidential election results.
You're awake, by the way. You're not having a terrible, terrible dream. Also, you're not dead and you haven't gone to hell. This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
To millions of Americans, Donald Trump was a symbol of bigotry, sexism, and racism. It was a time of mourning. Here's CNN's Van Jones.
This was a complete reinvention of politics and polls, it's true. But it was also something else. We haven't talked about race. This was a white lash. This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president, in part.
2016, the year our first black president prepared to leave office, and the year we elected our 44th white male president. A year of political disruption in America.
It's going to be a beautiful thing.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for that dispatch from the front.
We're joined now by Deborah Satz. She's professor of philosophy at Stanford. She's also Senior Associate Dean for Humanities and the Arts. She's the co-author of Occupy the Future. She's the source of wisdom and delight. Deborah, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, Deborah, you know, you could think about this in two ways, as our roving report kind of illustrated. On one hand, you could look at it as a triumph for democracy. I mean, the people rose up, took back control from out-of-control political elites, hardy political elites. You can also think of it as a kind of major defeat for democracy because it wasn't even a majority rule, and the people sought refuge, as Plato predicted democracy would devolve into, an authoritarian figure that they turned to nativism and scapegoating. Okay, so how should we think of it? As a triumph for democracy or as a defeat for democracy?
So this is a case where A and not A are actually both true. So you can think of this as democracy with an asterisk or democracy against itself. But it's clear that this was within the bounds of a legitimate election. The people elected a candidate. But the asterisk comes from the fact that only a minority of the population voted. So only 55% of registered voters voted in this election. Of course, a majority of the population voted for the losing candidate, even though the losing candidate lost. So that's an artifact of the Electoral College. We had two massively unpopular candidates running. So there's a question of whether the people actually got what they wanted out of the election. And we're seeing the erosion of the institutions that make democracy possible, including a commitment to procedures over outcomes. And that's on the part of both political parties, particularly the Republicans, but both political parties have engaged in tactics that have really undermined a commitment to democratic procedures. You know, we had Donald Trump saying the election was rigged, that, you know, he was going to imprison, you know, or prosecute his opponent. We've had gerrymandering going on for decades. We've had voter disenfranchisement. We've had a demonization on both sides of the opposite side, unwillingness to work together, and so forth. All of these are important mainstays.
You haven't even mentioned what's come to light more recently. It came to light during the election, but the press kind of gleefully ignored and took advantage of. I remember when the WikiLeaks stuff happened, every day there was a gleeful reading out of these leaked emails with barely a mention of where they came from. But they knew that they came from a hack, and they knew that it was most likely the Russians because the administration announced that. And you haven't even mentioned the foreign interference. Right. So this sounds like a really bleak story.
Sounds like a pretty big asterisk.
It is a big asterisk, but it's an asterisk that we have to take some responsibility for. We don't necessarily take responsibility for the Russian interference in the elections, but we have to take responsibility for the fact that so few of us turn out to vote. We have to take responsibility for the fact that we've allowed gerrymandering to go on, that we have not reformed the Electoral College or attempted to reform the Electoral
College.
You
say we have to take responsibility for this, and I kind of agree. But I have to say, I have come to believe, after thinking really hard about this for a while now, prior to this election, I have come to believe that we have an extraordinarily imperfect constitution, an extraordinarily flawed form of democratic self-governance. And I think it's because of the founding fathers, because they didn't really want democracy. And instead, they distrusted the will of the people. And they tried to corral and tame and check the will of the people. And instead of like thinking, how would we foster a culture of democratic participation and all that, they basically made it so hard to have democratic participation, right? And we've lived with that. And part of the consequence of that is the reason we don't vote and all that stuff is because we've become infantilized political agents, partly because of the structure of our democracy.
That's a pretty all-encompassing theory.
It is.
But remember, the founding fathers didn't foresee political parties. They saw the problems of democracy, many of which are real. But they didn't foresee, or if they did, the ones who foresaw it didn't make it very clear, the danger of political parties, where you have treacherous behavior, like saying the number one goal of our party is to prevent the reelection of Obama. That's treachery bordering on treason. So I think Deborah's answer was very Hegelian and even-handed. I'd say it was a crushing defeat for democracy and a victory for anti-democratic forces, mostly in the Republican Party, that have involved gerrymandering and we call it treachery? Yes, I dare.
Where do you come down to this? Because I'm kind of thinking we reap what our founders sow, and he's saying, well, they didn't. And you're saying something
more.
We
get the democracy that we deserve. And I think that we've allowed money in politics to play an enormous role. We've allowed media deregulation to go on. We haven't thought together about how to manage the public in this new age. The union movement has been decimated. A lot of the bulwarks against the takeover by elites of the political process have been undermined. So, I mean, yes, there is a sense in which there's been capture, But it's also true that the American public has stood by while disenfranchisement happens. We've allowed laws to be passed that weaken the ability of people to vote.
Well, see, this is why I say we're kind of reaping what our founders sowed, right? You say the American public has stood by, and then in a way, you're right, right? We have stood by and let things happen, but the means of political action, of political agency, are pretty remote and pretty dispersed and attached to lots of veto power. And because of gerrymandering, the politicians get to choose their voters. Voters don't without the voters having being completely free to choose their politicians, right? And all this stuff conspires and can happen because of the very structure of our polity. And so I think it's kind of in the long run predictable that there was a Lentz wrote the perils of presidentialism and argued that presidential democracies everywhere they've been tried, except the U.S., have basically collapsed around the world, and more newer democracies don't try out this kind of model with its multiple veto point, partly because parliamentary democracies are much more responsive, right?
But our democracy worked, you know, it's always been in formation. I mean, it's always been imperfect, but it worked much better in previous election cycles. And there really has become an ethos, as John was saying, of one side saying, you know, our politics is simply to make the government in power that's not our people not function. That's a change in the ethics of politics and the ethics of our leaders. And again, we get the democracy we deserve. We tolerate that. I don't think political parties are so much the problem. You need some form of organizing opinions, but the behavior of the political parties has become
problem. You're right. But I think you need to say, on the one hand, political parties may be inevitable, and maybe the founding fathers should have seen that, although there wasn't that much experience over the centuries. But that doesn't mean they're not the problem.
Well, right. And Lentz argues about this point, that the thing that made a American democracy of presidential democracies the exception was, he argued, the diffuseness of American political parties. He predicted that if American political parties became ideologically rigid rather than ideologically broadly coalitional and overlapping, then when you married all this veto power, you would get a collapse. And I think we're seeing that.
Right. But whether that's intrinsic to the party system to have that kind of polarization and lack of overlap, there's no reason to think that's an inevitable artifact of parties.
Okay, Deborah. Now, over your years at Stanford, and I've been here the whole time watching you develop into this wise and diplomatic and
that's true.
And talented.
As opposed to the way I used to be. Yes.
Well, you were young. You're really young and impetuous at science, you know. But so, given you're this font of wisdom, what do you do about this? We make you czar of the U.S. for a day.
Or
you
the world.
Just the U.S. You can pass any amendments you want. You can shoot anybody you want or imprison them. Just for a day, though. What are you going to do?
Plenary powers.
I'd like to see some structural changes, and I'd like to see some ethics. So on the ethics front, I think the norms that are governing people in public life, and that includes citizens, that citizens haven't been thinking ethically about the common good, that people have been thinking about their own interests, that the political parties, our leaders, have been thinking about winning at all costs without commitment to the process. So I'd like to see changes in ethics, and then I'd like to see some structural reforms. I'd like to see money get out of politics. I'd like to see campaign finance reform. I'd like to see reform of the Electoral College. I'd like to see regulation of the media. because there are epistemic conditions for democracy as well as other preconditions for democracy. And there's a lot of misinformation, and we're in a new world in the terms of media, and we have not thought about how to handle
that. But see, again, I think these two things go like hand in glove. And I think one of our mistakes is we haven't paid enough attention to how a structure and commitment to a structure helps or can help foster an ethos, and what kind of ethos a given structure will foster. Right? We don't have structures that make broad participation like automatic, and so it's hard for that structure to you have to have extra things to foster an ethos of broad participation.
But we could change. So one thing I'd also like to see is changes in the ability of people to vote. You know,
I totally agree.
Easier for people to vote, whether it's by, you know, automatic default, you know, registration for all citizens, or whether we fine people for not voting. Which
totally agree. But see, that's again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, although I know I am. But but if you had a constitution that guaranteed and didn't leave the overseeing of the vote to the states and their discretion to regulate the means of an election, but you said something had a constitutional edict, right? But we don't have such a constitutional edict.
Again, there are lots of reforms that could make voting a lot easier. We make it hard for people to register to vote, harder than it needs to be, and we need to, as I say, work on the ethics of citizens. You know, why is only 55% of the registered voters showing up in a presidential election where obviously a lot was at stake?
But isn't the solution kind of obvious? Calexit? Let's take California and leave the union. I mean, we're many times bigger than a whole bunch of poor, misbegotten eastern states stolen from the Native Americans that founded this misbegotten republic. Why, California will have a more positive impact on the world if it gets free of all the other states that are dragging it down. I'm not saying I'm fully convinced of this, but I want to hear what you have to think.
So I believe in the American project, and I'm, you know, committed to, California.
You believe in a republic founded on the land of Native Americans and slave labor. And the people in charge of that, we should just keep doing it the way they thought we should.
No. But the project was not... I agree with you about the founding, but the project is not about that.
So,
and I do think there's one truth in what you say, which is it's really important to build local politics. I mean, one thing Obama did not do enough was to build the political party, the Democratic Party, on the local level. The Republicans did an excellent job on the local level in a way that the Democrats have not.
Well, Deborah, you know, I wish we could talk about this for a couple more hours. We're just getting started, but I'm going to have to thank you. I have to thank you for joining us.
Okay, thanks.
Our guest has been Deborah Satz. She's a professor of philosophy at Stanford. She's also my boss. She's the senior associate dean of arts and humanities and arts. She's co-author of Occupy the Future. This is Philosophy Talk. It's our annual philosophical year in review, the examined year 2016.
The president-elect has promised to bring the jobs back to America. But what if the jobs are leaving not because of free trade and outsourcing, but because technology is making human work obsolete?
Technology and the disappearance of labor, when Philosophy Talk continues.
If that were a self-driving Corvette, would Prince have been out of a job? Well, probably not. He would have had more time to create music while he was being driven around. But at any rate, Prince was another great musician who left us in 2016. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and it's the examined year, 2016. It's our philosophical look at the past 12 months. Up next, the year in technology and labor.
Or lack of labor, from trucks and trains to taxis and the rest. Lots of working class Americans drive for a living. As our roving philosophical reporter Shuka Kalantari tells us, even those jobs are in danger. In 2016, we got our first self-driving delivery truck. Here's more from Wired.
It completed the world's first truck autonomous delivery, carrying 50,000 cans of Budweiser from a brewery in Fort Collins, Colorado, to Colorado Springs, 120 miles away.
In August, Uber, who also owns the company behind the self-driving truck, rolled out their first batch of driverless taxis in Pittsburgh. Here's the Financial Times with more.
The San Francisco-based company has outfitted more than a dozen Ford Fusion cars with lasers, cameras, and GPS sensors so that they can sense the environment around them and drive safely through all kinds of conditions, including snow and bridges and crowded streets.
But Uber's driverless cars don't do too well on bridges. They also have trouble with trees, animals, even other cars. Plus, security experts have already shown they can use the internet to take control of a car as it drives down the road. In December, Uber expanded its autonomous cars to San Francisco. It didn't go too well. CBS News has the details.
Only hours after a small number of Uber's experimental vehicles went into service in San Francisco, California's Department of Motor Vehicles ordered the testing to stop. Dashcam video captured what appeared to be one of Uber's specially equipped vehicles sailing through a red light, just as someone stepped off the curb.
2016, the year of driverless taxis and one driverless truck full of beer. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks for that report, Shuka. The year in driverless driving.
Joining us now is Margaret Levy. She's a professor of political science at Stanford, where she's also director of the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences. She's co-author of In the Interest of Others, Organizations and Social Activism. Margaret, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Margaret, you might think of the advances in driverless vehicle technology that we saw in 2016 as a triumph for big companies like Uber, but a defeat for workers like Uber drivers who were only working because, in many cases, they had already lost their previous jobs. Is this the right way to think about it?
No.
Really? Many people do think of it that way.
They
want to think that over for a minute?
Yeah. I'm going to say more. I think that's a wrong framing of the question. It's absolutely true that some workers are going to lose their jobs. Workers have lost their jobs over the centuries as we've created new technologies. The issue is really one of choice. It's choices about the market. It's choices about policies. It's choices about technology. And that's within the political domain. That's within the domain of economics. And we really need to think about what those choices are going to look like and who's going to make them and how we ensure that they're made in light of what I would call a moral economy. We've really got to rethink what goes into a market and what goes into our polity.
I'm not quite sure where this is leading. I mean, if I'm a company and I want to maximize profit and shareholder value and I want to minimize costs, maximize profit, it seems like a no-brainer. If I can get driverless cars, it takes away all my labor costs. Well, not all, because there's somebody got to maintain them,
right,
and all that sort of stuff. It takes away a lot of my labor costs. It makes it much cheaper for my consumers. So what do you mean it's a matter of choice?
But you're
it's
only
an inevitable market.
Because you're saying that the market is inevitable and that the market, the way it's structured now, is not a choice. We have government. We have regulations. In some places like San Francisco and Germany, they seem to work, where the government says, wait a minute, we need to understand what's going on. We need to think about who's being displaced and how they're going to be compensated if they're displaced. Let's widen this discussion to include coal miners who many of us would like to see displaced because we want the environmental protections that eliminating coal and coal mining would do. But we have some responsibility as a polity, as a society, for those who are displaced. Even if the decisions make sense from one perspective, they don't make sense for the whole.
So let me give you a hypothetical example. We got a community. It's got a factory. The factory employs 400 people. Some technology is discovered that does half the work that those 400 people do. Wouldn't the reasonable thing to be cut their hours in half, double their salary, and so they get the benefit of this new technology?
I think there's several.
Don't we need a political and economic philosophy that explains the reasonableness of that?
Absolutely. That's the way to think about it. And the way we've been talking about it is in terms of moral economies.
Mm-hmm.
that we really need to think about what kind of moral economy we want here, what kind we already have, what kind exists in other places. There's lots of variation in the sort of ethical choices that underlie these processes and that control the entrepreneurs who are clearly doing what makes sense from their very narrow perspective, but is not a societal perspective.
So I get you. I get you. But it does seem like now. So it was a triumph. Ooh, the arrival of driverless technology. I learned something in preparing for this show. Driving things is the largest single employer of lower skilled worker in the United States, and it's by far the best paying job for a low skilled worker on average in the United States. So, if you could eliminate that in one fell swoop, that's extraordinarily disruptive. And I totally agree with that. But the alternative, I don't quite see what the alternative is.
The alternative is to really think about other sources of training, other sources of jobs. We have a huge infrastructural problem in this country. In fact, in most countries. A lot of that's also good paying work, construction work of various kinds. It's also work that could absorb a huge amount of the population if we made some commitments to building some other things. We have an educational crisis. We have a child care crisis. These are jobs.
But I can totally get you. But there are people who think, smart people who think, and they don't think it out of, they just think technology is heading in this way, that an artificial intelligence technology in particular, the demand for human labor in almost all spheres is being put under great pressure, and the day is coming, some people predict. I don't know if they're right or wrong. It's an empirical question. But the day is coming when there will be no demand for human labor.
Well, one of the things that some of the technology work world is talking about, Tim O'Reilly represents this, is that as long as there are problems, there's work to be done.
Yeah.
And we're far from out of problems that need to be solved. Another way to think of it, if we think about it historically, we've had very disruptive technological periods in the past. From the Industrial Revolution, the conversation was about all the jobs are going to go away. Machines are now going to take over work. But we found that, in fact, work increased.
That's true. But some people claim, I don't know if they're right or wrong. Again, it seems to be an empirical question. But the test of it could be devastating, right? The experiment that answers that question. But here's some people claim that this is the first moment in history, a unique moment in history, where technology is a net destroyer of jobs rather than
That's right. There's no question that that argument is on the table, and it might well be right. But we then need to take responsibility as a society because there are lots of jobs that need to be done, lots of problems that need to be solved. We're always going to need people. We may need people enhanced by technology to help take care of the elderly. So a small person can lift a dead weight with the help of a Xenoskeleton or something like that. So technology could be enhancing a whole variety of jobs that we should be actually providing.
Let me ask you to imagine, what would we do if the future is as some people predict, I don't know if you want to call it a dark future or not, that the demand for human labor just disappears because anything that can be done better, more efficiently by a machine. What would we do?
Well, we'd have to find a way to support people who don't have jobs and to give them dignity because work is not just a source of income, it's also a source of dignity. And that requires some kind of basic income or some other process, but involves people in something that is active that may not be the traditional notions of work. I think about the Astor Gates' work in Chicago where he's renovating buildings and people come and do arts works there. Well, it's not work like driving a car or like mining coal, but it's nonetheless incredibly fulfilling. It creates a community, a society. It helps to solve some of the problems that Deborah was talking about in the last segment. It creates a group of people who want to vote and want to participate in their community.
Let me give you an example involving something dear to all of us, academia. So I don't think we'll be replaced by robots soon, but there's colleges all over the world that, with new technology, can get lectures from the elite places.
Right, MOOCs.
In the philosophy of language, we've got Ken and Mark Crimmins. I don't know who's giving philosophy of language this year, but I can imagine that the quality of philosophy of language teaching would be improved if little junior colleges and state colleges, I'm being slightly ironic here, and places where they're very backwards in the philosophy of language, like Massachusetts and England, were able to get Crimmins or Taylor piped in to give their lectures. So that would still leave grading for TAs to do.
More than
but
grading.
But it would kind of destroy the structure of philosophy.
One thing is that it would be good to disrupt academia. So I can't say that totally upsets me, because I think we really do need to rethink what we're doing at many of our universities and colleges. Two, you know, it's more than grading. It's also discussion. It's the development of critical thinking. It's not just getting – it's going to open – it could potentially open up a space for another kind of conversation to go on. Three, you know, what we have to do in our educational institutions is not just about learning particular things or learning particular skills, which we could do a better job of, but it's also about learning what it means to be a citizen, what it means to how the market is, in fact, manipulable by us.
Let me ask you one last question as we close this segment. We talked a lot about, in this recent campaign, about jobs, but technology and its impact on labor? It's never anywhere on the horizon. Why is that? I mean, that's a real present problem that we have to cope with wisely, and we didn't talk about it at all.
Well, one of the problems is the decline in the labor unions, who are very sensitive to this issue and are trying to deal with it. And the book you mentioned, In the Interest of Others, is about longshore workers and Teamsters. And the longshore workers over the last 80 years have been totally disrupted by technology as the cranes came in. It looked like all the jobs were going to go away. And then the ports came back. Trade increased, and it turns out you needed workers. Now they're going through another phase like that. But if you don't have workers who are organized and can speak to the effect of technology on their labor and on their lives, you're not going to make it part of the political discussion.
Well, that's a depressing thought, but you know, we have to end this conversation. We're just getting started. I'd love to have you back, and we can talk about this a lot more, because it's a huge issue. So I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Margaret Levy. She's a professor of political science at Stanford and director of our Center for Advanced Study of Behavioral Sciences, and she's co-author of In the Interest of Others, Organizations and Social Activism. We invite you to continue examining the year that was 2016 at our online community of thinkers at Philosopher's Corner, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
You can also become a partner in the community of thinkers at our website, philosophytalk.org. Now, how fast can this guy give us a rundown on a year-long process known as 2016? It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the number one memorable component of 2016, near as I can tell, was the rise and fattening of fake news. I'm not even sure, besides many calls for alarm, what is meant by fake news. Is MSNBC fake news because it has liberal bias? Is Fox News the propaganda arm of the Republican Party? We learned that a small town in Macedonia is the source of much pro-Trump, anti-Hillary fake news because the cost of living is so much lower there, a person can get by on the penny a line you get for cutting, pasting, and posting. There's the fake news that's just spin or wishful thinking, that Hillary stole California, how Bernie could have won, how the Electoral College would come to their senses. Trump's going to build that wall, and he cares about workers. He really does. Then we have the bizarre Trump tweets, which give lefties the vapors and the right-wing commentariat a chance to chuckle deep in their chests and put it out that Trump's little outbursts are baby steps towards gravitas. Remember the claim that a military training exercise in Texas was really an attempt by Obama to imprison Texans and bankrupt Walmarts? People believed that. Never happened. Remember when Alex Jones broke down sobbing on his InfoWars shows from the very idea that a Hillary Clinton cult could take over the country? Cast your mind back. Remember the satanic daycare centers? Alien abductions? Remember when George Washington chopped down the cherry tree? Never happened. Davy Crockett never killed a bear when he was only three. Donald Trump smokes cigars as big as baseball bats and had sex with stars from another planet. He's like Pecos Bill or Paul Bunyan, only strangely boring. There's fake news that's obviously bull, and the debunking of the bull is also bull. How do we know? The trouble is, we're either low-information people who only hear what we want to hear, or we're high-information people who don't believe anything. I had lefty friends on Facebook not convinced Russians hacked the DNC because the CIA made the claim, and the CIA can't be trusted. But Trump made pretty much the same claim. Does that mean he's left-wing? He ignores intelligence briefings, yet he appeared on Alex Jones' show. Does he trust Alex Jones more than the CIA? His incoming security advisor, General Michael Flynn, helped spread a story that a D.C. pizza joint was actually cover for Hillary Clinton's sex trafficking. So some nutcase showed up at the pizza place with a gun. I mean, come on. Doesn't the incoming National Security Advisor have better sources about Hillary's sex trafficking? Isn't the FBI just down the street? How about the spies will be working for you come January? Ask them to order a pizza. See if an Albanian sex slave shows up. Anyway, fake news turned into real news the way it do. Same old imperial fantasies of power and paranoia. My favorite is the fuss over the term alt-right. People are upset that white supremacy is rebranding, and we're buying it as a real thing. But the thing is, alt-right does not bring these folks into the 21st century. It brings them back to the 1990s. News groups, Usenet, alt-sex blondes, alt-sex bestiality, alt-right. Maybe that's the great America Trump wants to bring us back to. Covertly racist news groups. Flame wars. Remember those? It's all trolls now. But maybe this time around, in Trump's great new empire, we will find weapons of mass destruction in the tiny little country we destroy. Maybe the free market liberation hedge fund guys won't crash the economy quite so bad. And when the investigation proves that the Russians did try their damnedest to throw the election to Trump, somehow the public perception will be, once again, that crooked Hillary, if she'd just stayed home, none of this would have happened. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
2016 has been the worst.